Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Player One Riley.
Hootin' and hollering, living it up. This is like
hollering.
Our walkout music. I mean, I feel like we could be in an NBA All-Star game.
Huh.
Get the movie voice guy, get the upbeat music. Do not have Fergie sing the national anthem.
That is a definite agreement.
No, get her back.
Also with us
take
tonight.
Take the focus off of how bad we are at basketball. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we need some distractions.
Okay.
Speaking of distractions, also with us tonight is Spencer, player two, Williams.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
How goes it, Spencer?
It's going well.
Are you
going
to go on a basketball ramp as well?
No, okay. I'm the last player that needs to be on a basketball court right now.
Well, there you go. So, we're going to transition from basketball into movies like this show is about. We are excited to talk about a movie that has not come out yet. Actually, it debuts this week, and we are so stoked because we got an early screening of Ready Player One.
Eddie, in particular, is very stoked.
Oh, yeah, I am.
He's been ready for this for a while.
Oh, heck yeah.
Years.
So, stick around as we jump into the show. But before we start, of course, Chad has a little bit of info for you.
I do. Like an oasis of sensible talk among the gossip-laden debris field of pop culture, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. And like a James Halliday challenge, riddles and clues about the latest movie debuts are available in cyberspace wherever you can find an internet connection. New episodes of the Filmlosophers... Oh, I didn't even say our name right. The Filmlosophers.
It's true.
Debut each Wednesday on Libsyn, Player FM, Google Play, Stitcher, Audio Boom, and iTunes. And now,
Yuppers.
You can also find us on Spotify.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Spotify.
Surprises abound.
I know. What's also surprising is where else they can find us in the interweb. Spencer, tell them where else we can go.
Ready to take your place at the top of the discussion leaderboard? You can join the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. You don't need a key to access our episode library. It's always available on demand on our website.
Well, we got a website.
Website. Visit filmlosophers.com and catch up on anything you've missed.
That's right. We have a website. We're loud and proud. And what
we're
are you
on Spotify.
Do about
I mean,
it?
We're basically official now.
That's true. We
3 years in, we finally made it.
Exactly. We're big
three.
Time now. But speaking of big time, yes, we are excited for the film that is about to debut this Friday. It's the film that a lot of critics have been talking about because of the fact of the screenings at South by Southwest. Because of all the awesome conversations that people have been having with the author and the director. It's been getting a lot of press. It's been getting a lot of just attention lately. And that is obviously Ready Player One. The novel itself debuted a few years back. And ever since it's been out, people have been so excited to see this particular project being made into a film. Me being one of them. I was a really big fan when the book came out. And I believe, Spencer, you've read it as well.
I have.
As usual, I have not.
It's true. But we're not going to hold that against you.
I like
you.
To go in with a fresh perspective.
It's a smart way of saying I didn't read the book. So,
nor did I have the book read to me because one of you gave me an Audible copy where it's like somebody, what is it, Will Wheaton?
Yeah, Will Wheaton.
Just reads it to you. Well, I didn't listen to that either.
Well, I'll tell you what. Since you didn't read it, Chad, I was going to call you Spencer, you can actually read the awesome synopsis that we have.
Oh, good. It'll teach me something.
There we go.
Set in 2045, the world is on the brink of chaos and collapse. The people, however, have found salvation in the Oasis, an expansive virtual reality universe created by the brilliant and eccentric James Halliday. When Halliday dies, he leaves his immense fortune to the first person to find a digital Easter egg he has hidden somewhere in the Oasis, sparking a contest that grips the entire world. When an unlikely young hero named Wade Watts decides to join the contest, he is hurled into a breakneck, reality-bending treasure hunt through a fantastical universe of mystery, discovery, and danger.
I almost put the entire synopsis, which looked like the size of a book anyway. So thankfully this
Oh, you know I'd read it.
Based on Ernest Cline's best-selling novel of the same name, the film is directed by the iconic Steven Spielberg and stars Ty Sheridan, Olivia Cooke, Ben Mendelsohn, Mark Rylance, Simon Pegg, Lena Waithe, T.J. Miller, and many, many others. Written in 2011, the science fiction novel rose to prominence during the time when young adult books book popularity was at its peak. The novel was heralded as the ultimate love letter to the 80s.
It was self-published at first also, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's what's even more remarkable. He self-published, and then it caught on, and then it got further distribution as a book, and then it got optioned into a movie, and he actually has co-screenwriting credit on adaptation. Yeah.
It was really cool, because when the book came out the second time around, when it actually got the big push from an actual distributor, from a publisher, there was an actual competition in the release of the book. So Ernest Cline put a clue in the book for people to find, and the person who would find it would actually win his customized 1980s DeLorean that had been modified to look like the DeLorean from Back to the Future.
Of course it had.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, somebody won it.
In the marketing world, we call that living your brand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was super cool, because like at the time, people are reading about this fictional competition, this fictional contest, and winning this huge prize. And on the surface, the author is actually giving away something really, 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 really cool.
I mean, minus the fact that it's a DeLorean, but yeah.
It's a DeLorean.
Cool to look at, not cool to like operate.
Well, it's cool for speeding down the highway and getting a traffic ticket in.
It's true.
If it can do that.
Just tell the officer you're trying to get back to the future.
Well,
I was going 88 miles an hour to see you. To make sure you were born, officer. Never mind.
Oh, dear.
But as I said, this was a film that a lot of people had been anticipating. There had been a lot of buildup. There had been a lot of hype. The book itself is very unique. It's very creative. Many critics at the time heralded as this cross between Willy Wonka and The Matrix. And I think the book itself really epitomizes that. It really does bring about that type of, just childlike wonder in terms of wanting to see more and wanting to see how deep the rabbit hole goes, if you will, to quote Morpheus from The Matrix.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting, even in our real world, about the idea of virtual reality, immersive digital environments, right? Because up until this point, in any civilization, we've had our imaginations to individually kind of experience. You know, if you read a good book, or if you, you know, just, I don't know, sit on the grass in the summer or look up at the clouds and see shapes, and you kind of have your own imagination landscape, and maybe you can share some of that, you know, through describing it back and forth with your friends. But now with, you know, gaming and virtual environments and all of that, you've got shared spaces, imaginative spaces that don't have to follow all the rules of physics or logic or whatever. And you can have shared experiences in a shared imagination world, if you will. And here we have kind of an extended rollout of what that could look and feel like in, well, not too long from now.
True. Mm-hmm. It's very true, because, I mean, you have... We were just actually talking about it yesterday. You know, we were walking to the theater, and as we were walking, we passed by what looked to be a virtual reality cafe.
Indeed, yeah.
And as we were walking by, we were like, oh, we had noticed it there before, and we were looking at all the different types of games, and Chad was the first one to point out, oh, look, there's a Cowboys and Aliens type of thing or whatnot or something. And people can, so the idea of people going into this and obviously paying money and escaping from reality to do something unique and fun like that, it's already here, essentially.
Sure.
And then you look at all the technology that comes out of like E3, you know, all these great conventions, all these, you know, electronic conventions that are out there, and you're hearing about like the new Vive or the new, you know, whatever's coming out that, you know, people can immerse themselves into their favorite games. How far off are we to creating something that's a like general platform? I mean, what would it take for Xbox to ultimately create a general platform where people can jump into their virtual reality avatar and go about, you know, chatting? I mean, you can already do that on a certain level, but not to the immersiveness of actually being in the platform.
Right.
Which is something I think like Nintendo has been trying to do with back when they first came out with the Wii and they were creating a lot of those little avatars, and you could, they had this little world where your avatar could, you know, interact with other avatars from all over the world. Imagine this on just the next level. So,
well, and they already have virtual reality cafes with the kind of the treadmill like moving, like walking apparatuses, and you harness yourself in, and you know, it doesn't have the full body haptic interface necessarily that we see in the movie, but that's like tomorrow, essentially, we'll have those. So it's interesting because you look at, Steven Spielberg, who directed this film, and who actually has prominence from what I understand in the book, in terms of a lot of the references in the book are to his films from the 80s and the influence that he has had on pop culture. And he's always been a futurist to some degree in most of his films.
Oh, yeah.
And you get, you know, a lot of things like Minority Report, right? The self-driving cars and the displays in the mall that recognize who you are based on your retina, and they personalize your shopping experience before you're even in the store and all that kind of stuff that, you know, it was kind of wildly futuristic. People looked at that movie and said, oh, that's 30 years, 40 years down the road, that that kind of stuff would be more likely to start happening. And now the difference between what we see in Ready Player One and where, not all cultures, but, you know, some cultures around the world are at in terms of their use of technology and the resources available to them, it's tomorrow. Like, it's not 30 or 40 years away. It's now.
No, it's true. And I think the reason why, I think one of the big reasons why this film, or why this book, mind you, because I'm talking about the book first before we even get into the film, but why the book clings so heavily to like things like video games is because if you look at where most of technology is being placed for public consumption, it's in video games. I mean, most of the rendering engines and all the types of things that allow people to just, for entertainment purposes, so much money is going into the video game industry, and it's incredible. I mean, Spencer, you could probably speak to this more than I can, but I mean, how much is the video game industry moving in terms of new, latest, and greatest, as opposed to like everything else that's coming about? You're in IT as well, so.
Yeah. Well, latest and greatest, a lot of things are just all over the place. Like, you've got lots of research in cell phones. How can we make those better? How can we make laptops lighter? How can we make people actually use tablets? Those types of things. And with like VR stuff, like it's been rapidly improving because like you had like Oculus and HTC right now, like controlling like most of the market to like try to get people into VR, and the experiences are changing on like almost a daily basis on what you can actually do out there. So it's kind of been interesting to watch from afar. I haven't tried it yet myself, but I'm kind of interested, especially with that cafe. I saw that and I'm like, I want to try that out.
Well, and the Oculus is the one that came out with the developer's kit, which when they first unveiled their whole entire product, they also offered a developer's kit for indie developers and individuals who wanted to learn how to create games for that platform. And I think that was one of the biggest and smartest moves that really went so far under the radar for most people, because not many people realize that if you can do, if you can create a solid VR game that works on a platform that is not going anywhere within the next 20, 30, 40 years, honestly, in terms of like dwindling away, then you can honestly create something unique and special that could make you rich. I mean, look at all the people who started on YouTube. Nobody thought posting a video to the internet would get them paid, but people who started back in like 2007, 2006, like Philip DeFranco and all these other YouTubers are now gaining tons of revenue because of what they do daily. Like this, the HTC Vive and the Oculus Rift are pretty much the two biggest powerhouses for this particular endeavor. Like one's Gregorian, what is the name of Halliday's company?
Gregarious Games.
Gregarious Games, and the other one is IOI.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Don't know which one's who or who's who.
Who's the good guy and who's the bad guy?
Who knows, but I'm just saying Oculus did give did have those developer kits. But we say all that to say that because of the fact that video games and technology has such an impact into this particular story, those are one of the things that really has to translate well when you make an adaptation. I think this entire month of March has been a month of adaptations because we've been talking about it for the last 2 weeks with Wrinkle in Time and then Tomb Raider. And so we went from a story novel to just a plain Jane film. And then we had a video game that went into an actual decent, really good video game film. And now we're into back to novels. But it's interesting to see that in the three instances that we've had adaptations this month alone, there's a unique difference between all three in terms of how they took the information from that source and created a property that is, you know, pretty much for mainstream consumption. And this was one of those pieces that I would probably say it was an interesting film. It was interesting in the respect of, you know, the choices they made and the things like that, but
which we should probably tell our loyal listeners who like to listen to the show as soon as it goes live. Mm-hmm. And obviously you mentioned that this is going live before the film is actually in theaters. You've got a couple more days to wait if you're listening on Wednesday. So you should know. Light spoilers. I don't think we're going to do anything remarkably spoilery.
No.
And especially if you've read the book, then you're already pretty well clued into the general flow of the story. But we're going to talk. We're going to touch on a few things that were different in that adaptation, in the translation from page to screen.
Very true. I'm glad you brought that up.
Some spoilers.
Some spoilers. So let's go ahead and kick this off real quick. So obviously, as you know, we start out with expectations. And I'm going to go ahead and let Chad go first.
Oh,
because I feel I feel like anything that will be said by Chad, and then I can build on that with everything else that I would like to say. I'm going to let you give the base, and then I'm going to give the expansive.
Oh, okay. Well, my brain actually surprisingly was very simple. I was very simple minded in looking toward the premiere of this film. I, as we mentioned, I have not read the book, and I've only listened to about two chapters on Audible, so I'm going to finish it. I will listen to the whole book and see what the differences were. It'll just be after the fact, but I think that it's ever since seeing the Iron Giant in the teaser trailer, I was like, oh, okay, this movie's going to be fun. It's going to have some stuff in it that's just... don't have to know all of the references intimately necessarily, but just enough to pick up on some of the pop culture elements that are in there, in addition to obviously all the brand new characters and settings. So that, and then when I saw the T-Rex and King Kong from the car chase sequences and the giant wrecking balls and the DeLorean and all kinds of things, I really expected sort of like I went into the film thinking this is going to probably be similar to a motion simulation ride.
Like those ones you go to when you're in San Francisco or something.
Yeah, or like at an amusement park. Yeah. You've got the big screen and the seats kind of move, or you're in an enclosed space and the whole thing moves and shifts around. And so I thought, oh, well, minus the movement part, I bet that's what a lot of the feel and flavor of the movie is going to be. So I was looking forward to it because I do like those kinds of rides at amusement parks. So I had high expectations. I would say I didn't expect to appreciate as much of the story as the two of you or anyone else who had read the books or, quite frankly, who like really, really remembers the 80s. I grew up in the 80s, but my memory tends to delete things out of the long-term pile, and I don't remember them, even if I have seen them, heard them, you know, watched them on TV, whatever. So I didn't expect to get very many references aside from the obvious ones, and I'm pretty sure that's what happened. I'm pretty sure there are a lot of subtle things that I completely missed.
All right, Spencer.
Okay.
By the way, he didn't say anything that you were going to say, did he?
No.
Okay, just because that's usually the... Okay, go ahead.
Nailed it. Yeah, for me, like, I read... Well, I've listened to the book. I was listening to Will Wheaton on Audible. He's just a treasure, national treasure, that man.
Who, Will Wheaton?
National treasure.
Wesley Crusher is your national treasure.
You heard it here. We can probably guarantee first ever. Spencer Williams. Will Wheaton is a national treasure.
Oy. All right. So anyway.
Yeah.
I listened to the book. And I had no idea how they were going to possibly condense this story down into, like, I didn't realize it was 2.5 hours because it did not feel like it. It was actually rather a short movie, felt like to me, which is weird. But yeah, just going into it, I kind of didn't really have an idea of what they were going to do with this movie because there's just so much from the book. And they kind of made a lot of interesting changes because, well, they had to. Like, there was no way they could have done, like, the book verbatim unless they wanted to do, like, a miniseries of, like, 4 movies of something. So, you know, I just kind of walked into it not really sure what was going to be up.
Hmm. That's it?
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure. Okay. We'll wiping my hands, getting ready. Okay.
Oh, here we go. He's gonna bring the pain right now.
So there was 2 levels of expectations.
Eddie already hated this movie before he walked into the theater.
Levels. So many levels.
There was 2 levels here for me. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of the book. I've read the actual physical copy of the book several times over. I've listened to the audiobook several times over. That's 1 level. And then my 2nd level is the fact of if you've listened to this podcast for any good length of time, you know how much of a fan of the 80s I am. In terms of just...
Your name might as well be 80s Villanueva.
Probably. I might go to the courthouse and have it changed tomorrow. Mm. But... I love anything that is a love letter to the 80s. I love anything that brings homage to the 80s. I love anything that is giving the 80s its due in terms of its impact in culture and just society all around. There's tons of stuff that people are still building off of and still talking about and still mentioning in terms of pop culture and so forth from the 80s. And you know what? It was just a really cool and hip time. So... coming into this film, I was first off hoping that the film itself, yes, I agree with Spencer, there's so much in the book that you just can't translate. If you were to translate the entire book into a film, that'd have to be like at least a 12-hour movie. Mm-hmm. In at least, and that's best case scenario. Worst case scenario, it's a multi-part, 3-season-long trip.
Which we should say is not unheard of.
No, not at all.
For a well-structured book that has twists and turns and multiple characters,
yep.
You have to cut things out when you adapt it to a 2 or 2.5 hour movie.
Right.
Exactly. So, like, that was expected. That was very much expected. But I was still hoping that the film was going to carry a lot of the key elements that made the book.
I see what you did there. Key.
No, but...
Sorry.
I didn't do
Forgive
it. He
me.
Did it.
I did it. I did it.
So there was the hope that there was still any kind of resemblance to the original story with a lot of the main key points of the story translated well in the film. So that was the first level. My 2nd level is how many times the book itself creates a reference to the 80s. Because the entire story, the entire structure of the book itself is based on 80s pop culture. Like, anything and everything. Like, you turn a page and there's at least 12 different references to an 80s song, an 80s movie, an 80s video game, an 80s, you know, piece of entertainment, something or whatever. There's always going to be something that references back to the 80s. So I was really hoping that this film still lent itself that much to the 80s. It still really leaned heavily on how much the information was pertinent to the story. Not just it being a backstory, not just it being like, oh, well, yeah, you know, I guess he liked the 80s, whatever. But it was the story itself focused on the 80s as a key no pun intended, key focus in the film.
Well, essentially, in the book, the way it's set up, because I did listen to the first couple chapters, the way it's set up is if you don't pay attention to 80s culture, you will not be able to solve mm-hmm. the puzzles, right. find the keys, get the egg, win the game, yeah. if you will.
No, 100%. And that's part of what really was driving me, was really, you know, swaying my thoughts on the film, was hoping that it still kept that same focus in terms of James Halliday was a child of the 80s, he was a product of the 80s, and he was a lover of the 80s. And every ounce of that oozed throughout every point of his game, throughout every aspect, throughout every challenge, throughout every, you know, planet that people would visit that has his mark on it. So those were the two main things. Those are the two main, you know, levels of where I was viewing. Those are the two lenses that I was viewing this film through, in hopes that it really hit certain boxes for each of these categories.
So for anybody who has not read the book, mm-hmm. and obviously if you're listening before Friday, you have not seen the movie yet, something that may be helpful for you to know is that this James Halliday guy is essentially like the... he's not even the Steve Jobs. He's the like developer behind Steve Jobs, who made this incredible, life-changing, world-changing virtual environment called the Oasis. And the way that the story starts out, and here's a minor spoiler if you don't know anything about it, the story starts essentially with Halliday dying, and then he has sort of a video will that is distributed to anyone in the world, anybody with access to the Oasis, announcing that he's hidden an Easter egg somewhere in this virtual universe. And in order to get to the Easter egg, you have to solve three puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
You have to accomplish these three feats, these three challenges. And whoever can do that first and get to the egg will inherit the entire Oasis, which is valued at, you know, whatever quadrillion, trillion, however much money. And basically you could rule the world.
I think the movie actually says they would win half a trillion, I think it was. I think it was $500 billion. But no, and that sets it up pretty much in the get-go of the film, as well as the book. The book actually begins with that as well. So yeah, I mean, in terms of expectations, I had a lot, but I do have to admit, and this was one of the conversations that you and I had, Chad, that before walking into the theater, you had asked me, and I said, well, I had been pretty high on my level of expectation for a good portion of the time that the film has been in, you know, being promoted, up until a few weeks ago when South by Southwest was going on, and there was a surprise screening out there, and
mm-hmm.
tons of people ultimately came out of that screening with mixed reviews, with mixed thoughts. And it was one of those things where, to me, if somebody who is going to go see this film, first off, they have to have an interest in the film itself or in the book to go and actually stay up the late, however time, whenever they did the film, the screening. And so it had to be people who were aware of the story. And number two, had to be people who were actually interested in hoping that this was a success. There was a level of interest in the success of this film. And so it did kind of scare me a bit in terms of a lot of the confusion and a lot of the ups and downs of some people were like, oh, it was good, it was really good. And some people were like, oh my gosh, it was horrible, it was this, this, and that. So, yeah, needless to say, I was a little bit up in the air in hoping that this film was going to be a success.
It took you down a notch.
It did.
Not a massive notch, but a little notch.
Just by a bit. So with that said, we're going to jump right into the actual review itself. We're going to kind of talk about a couple of the characters. And the main character, obviously, is Wade Watts. We've mentioned it, played by Ty Sheridan. If you don't know who Ty Sheridan is, he's the kid who played Cyclops in...
X-Men Apocalypse.
There you go. So you're introduced to Wade Watts. He's this run-of-the-mill young teenager. He's essentially supposed to be a senior in high school. I don't think it actually mentions it in the film, but he's supposed to be a senior in high school. He lives in Cleveland, Ohio. In the year 2045.
Columbus. I think it's Columbus, Ohio. Columbus. But yeah, fastest growing city on Earth.
And they live in stacked up RVs.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody pretty much, as you see him walking around, everybody's just so entranced and engaged with the Oasis. So you recognize early on that Wade lives in a world where everybody spends the majority of their time escaping to the Oasis. Wade, he seems like the typical introvert type of character who spends most of his time trying to be extrovert online. I think Ty Sheridan does a really good job of portraying that shyness, that ability to kind of not be comfortable with the real world, but when it comes to the Oasis world, he could just be himself, look like he's got tattoos, crazy hair, he's focused on how he looks. I mean,
yeah, they have a really cool line when you first are being introduced to, when you as the audience are mm-hmm. being introduced to the Oasis, you kind of fly through different types of worlds.
Mm-hmm.
That I really wish we could have gone back and visited again, that beach world with the wave and everything.
Yep.
Oh, man, cool. Or skiing down the pyramid.
Yep.
Pyramids at Giza.
Or climbing Mount Everest with Batman.
Right.
That was cool.
Yeah, so they introduce you very quickly, just mm-hmm. a fly-through, if you will, of different zones, different worlds within the Oasis. And then as you come upon sort of the library area, if you will, there's a line about how, you know, up to the before the Oasis was created, you know, you could use technology to do almost anything, and then when the Oasis, now with the Oasis, you can be anything.
Yeah,
you can literally become digitally, virtually, you can become somebody completely different than who you are, in terms of everything, your origin story, your, you know, what if you're human or alien or animal or plant or whatever, you can do whatever. There's no real definable limit,
yeah,
in terms of the concept of your avatar.
And one of the things that this film does is it really does streamline the introduction of the key characters, because obviously, with the book, that does take a little bit of time as you get the introduction of, you know, the main characters like H and Artemis and Sho and Daito. So in this one, you're pretty much introduced to the entire cast of the main five in the one of the first challenges that everybody seems to have stumbled upon, everybody knows about. And so you're introduced to H, which is Parzival, which is his username, Wade Watts's username. H is his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're also introduced to Sho and Daito, who are two other individuals that are in that little circle of friends. And you're also introduced to Artemis. Artemis is this female gunter or egg hunter, as they call them in the games. And she's a part of this group as well. And she's well already aware of everybody's character. She's already aware of everybody who is in that group. Whereas in the book, it takes a little bit for them to actually introduce themselves to all the rest of the individuals.
Yeah, in the book, like, the thing about the movie is, like, initially, like, Wade, like, goes to the Oasis, and then he just hops to a different world. And by that, I was, like, instantly confused, because that's not how the book works.
Mm.
And so, like, if you're going in expecting, like, verbatim the book, you're going to get lost real quick.
Yeah.
So it's kind of something where it's like walking to a parallel world of, like, all the characters are here, but they're doing slightly different things.
Yeah, it's really unique. So to kind of give Chad insight, because I see Chad's eyes and they're kind of confused. So according to the book, you need credits to move to go anywhere off world. So when you jump into the Oasis, usually for people under the age of 18, it's usually for school. So I don't know if you remember that zooming through those worlds. There mm-hmm. was a world yeah. that it zoomed through called Ludus. Ludus is the school planet, if you will. It's the planet that everybody gets populated on when they have a school-issued rig so that they can attend school in the right. Oasis. But if you don't have credits, you can't go off-world to other places to fight battles to get coins so that you can continue to do that. So Wade has pretty much been stuck on Ludus for all the years that he's actually been playing in the Oasis. Yeah.
Interesting.
So in order for him to try
to... Yeah, it doesn't work that way in the movie.
No.
And so that was an interesting aspect as well to me, because I was watching and I'm like, I'm hearing him talk about something and I'm like, wait, where's he going? It took me a second to kind of switch gears and realize I'm not watching, like Spencer said, and you put it so well. Thank you for putting that. Saying that it's not verbatim to the book. It's very much in the same vein of the overall story, but there are elements of this film that deviate from the main storyline, that being one of them. Wade doesn't have to work as hard to move off-world or to go to different places, apparently, in this one. And the challenges have already been... The first challenge has already been found, and pretty much nobody's been successful in, you know, figuring it out. So that was a little bit of a throw for me. But it is a great way to introduce the first five characters that you're, you know, going to be pretty much following throughout the rest of the film. H being this hulking-looking orc with a very, very obvious voice modification. It sounds like somebody who's twerking their voice for the character.
Sure.
Then obviously Sho and Daito and Artemis, which that was another interesting aspect of that. It's a little bit more of a pursuit in the book to kind of introduce himself to Artemis, but seeing as they're all established in this unique little clique.
Well, and you only have 2.5 hours, so exactly. You kind of do need to cut some of the extra side quests, if you will, to borrow a gamer term, because I'm such a gamer.
Look at that. That sounded pretty legit to me.
Actually, yeah, like the opening narration to this movie actually made me kind of nervous, because like he was setting up so much stuff. I was like, oh no, this movie might not work, because it just felt like it might have been too much.
That narration. Oh, there goes the first 6 chapters of the book. Okay. No, just... And then, of course, you're obviously introduced to the other side of this coin. You're introduced to the IOI individuals, such as Nolan Sorrento, played by Ben Mendelsohn. And is it just me, or did Ben Mendelsohn look like the principal from Breakfast Club? Because he looked just like it. Like, I half expected him to say, you play with the bull, you're going to get the horns kind of thing. Like, he looked like him. He even had, like, the gray suit, the you know, the salt and pepper hair. You know, his face looked like it a little bit. So, I don't know. But he played a really good Nolan Sorrento. Like, how I envisioned him in my mind, I was a little worried because it was Ben Mendelsohn. I've never known him to be anything other than Director Krennic. So, I'm not too sure if this was going to be a good role for him. But he nails it for me.
He's
a good bad guy.
I was expecting slightly more menacing, because like the book version of Nolan Sorrento, just the opening of him offering certain things to Wade to get information from him, and then just doing like this very fast, like 90-degree, we're going to kill you type thing, was just kind of crazy.
Mm. That's true. But then in that one, he is visiting with his avatar as opposed to his real person. Where's this one? So as well as him, you're introduced to the whole IOI construct itself, what IOI is working to do, which is to take over the Oasis by winning the grand prize, the Easter egg, and inundating every single headset with as much ads as they can.
Yeah, they want to commodify the space. It's no longer free.
Which was pretty interesting to hear. Like, oh, we could cover up to 88% of the user's, you know, haptic face before they go into seizures and whatever. I'm like, oh, okay.
That sounds legit.
That's promising. But I thought for the...
And
for
what kind of research did you do to figure that out?
I don't want to know.
Induced seizures.
but it was interesting. I think for the scope of this type of film, I thought he was a good choice now that I've seen him perform in this role. You're also obviously introduced to a lot of side characters. You're introduced to his aunt and his aunt's boyfriend. A lot of
Wade,
little people.
Wade's aunt and boyfriend.
Not Nolan Sorrento's aunt.
His parents are no longer around, so he's living with his aunt, and she has a string of terrible guys in her life, and this most recent one is a deadbeat and, you know, Not a likable guy, but she's not very likable either.
True.
No.
Very true.
I don't know how it compares to the book because, again, I'm only a couple chapters in.
No, she's really horrible in the book. She's worse in the book.
Really?
Dude, she like steals his laptop so that they can pawn it to get money. Really? another character, and it totally slipped my mind, that obviously you're introduced to is I-Rock, played by T.J. Miller. The thing about T.J. Miller, and I know this is going to come off really wrong, but this is just the way I'm going to have to put it. I don't like his face, but I like his voice. And I think his voice does really well for like awkward moments, like how he played this character. So if you're familiar with the book, I-Rock is not the other classmate in this film. I-Rock is this kind of mercenary in the game. He's somebody who just pretty much works for hire, doing really malicious and bad stuff to other players in the game. Whereas in the book, I-Rock is just some other poser who tries to come off as a educated gunter, but totally gets constantly put down and made fun of by Wade and H in the Oasis, obviously. But in this one, I-Rock, like I said, is this mercenary, and he's constantly working for Nolan Sorrento. I really did enjoy the deviation from this one, obviously, to streamline the storyline and to really kind of get his character in there, because you got to have somebody who's that wishy-washy individual who's just, you know, I will work for me and no one else. I thought the character worked. I'm really glad that the character didn't look anything like T.J. Miller.
T.J. Miller.
No, I just don't like the way he looks. I mean, his face, it's punchable. I'm just saying.
I mean, this dude has a skull for a body.
He does.
And like a metal skull face that you see through.
So I could
his torso.
But so as an audience member,
so
I
you
could
find
easily,
that more likable than Miller's
I
life
find it
face?
Easier. No, I find it easier to hate this particular character, whereas T.J. Miller, I have no reason to, yet his face just, it's like a catcher's mitt ready for my hand, you know? I don't know.
Wow. I mean, that's a very strong claim. I've not known you to be this violent or opinionated about another man's face.
I'm just not a fan of T.J. Miller's look, okay? But I thought his character...
But you like his voice.
But I think his voice works really well for the comedic purposes of this film. And
yeah, his sarcasm definitely bleeds through in his voiceover work with this character. You don't need to... I mean, not only do you not need to see his face, you don't even need good animation of the character to catch the sarcasm. That's how good he is at that tone.
Yeah.
As a performer.
And obviously, of course, you were also introduced to James Halliday, played by Mark Rylance. Now, I'm going to be very brutally honest. I didn't think Mark Rylance could have pulled this off, but Mark Rylance is the man.
Oh, yeah.
He nails James Halliday to a T from the book. Because you dive deeper, obviously, into the story of James Halliday in the book, and you see more of like a lot more of his awkwardness, a lot more of his just... Because James Halliday had this huge issue of being in social areas. He was always working. In fact, according to the book, the last few years of his life, he spent all his time in his house. He never came out for years. And so Ogden Morrow had said he had just kind of put that off as just him being him.
Which Ogden Morrow is his business partner.
Played by Simon Pegg. But the amount of awkwardness that the book really goes to in depth to really establish that, Mark Rylance does just by looking at him. It's like you're watching this man fumble through stuff, looking for all these little things, and it's like, oh my gosh, this dude is so socially awkward. But you enjoy it. You're like watching, you're like, oh my gosh, this guy, I would love to see another film just with diving more into his story with Mark Rylance playing the character. And I'll be the first to admit, I didn't think Mark Rylance could have done it this well. The last thing we saw him in was Dunkirk, and he played a boat captain. And it was like, okay, this boat captain's going to play James Halliday.
Well, Oh, go ahead.
So, reading the book, like, I couldn't quite picture this guy as a person, like James Halliday. I had no idea, like, he was so awkward. I couldn't really figure out, like, how could a person like this function? And then upon seeing the movie, I'm like, that's Al. That makes so much sense, like, versus what I was hearing, that I was like, okay, that's definitely how James Halliday would be. Plus, also, I did not know that was Simon Pegg. Like, I kept looking at him. I'm like, is that Simon Pegg? And that was, it was.
Yeah. Simon Pegg, he's not in the film for very long, but scenes he's in.
You know, honestly, neither is Mark Rylance.
It's true.
I mean, very neither true. One of them are really in the movie very much.
No.
But I think, from my perspective,
yeah,
it's very refreshing to hear you praise Rylance's performance as James Halliday, because I thought it was the only solid performance in the movie. Mm. And he's not even in it very much. Like, mm-hmm. the rest of them, it was sort of like, oh, okay, fine. We're like a little too two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Because of how much story you've got to chew through plot-wise. You just have to move from this challenge to that challenge to... And when part of the big takeaway, at least in the movie, I'm assuming it's somewhat similar in the book, but at least in the movie, a big part of the takeaway is the value of actual human connections in the real world, mm-hmm. when you become so desensitized to the real world by entering this fake world,
mm-hmm.
right? You're escaping all the time to where your quote-unquote real life is happening in the fake space, and your fake life that you don't put a lot of yourself into is happening in the natural world, the natural environment. And the characters need to come to realize the value of actual human interaction face to face, five senses, you know, in a visceral, physical way. And I thought that was an important part of the story that was a little bit underserved, because you've got so much action adventure, you know, challenge-y stuff to chew through. Not that it wasn't enjoyable, but there wasn't really a lot of room for the characters to be fully developed. They
True.
Kind of just needed to be one note so that you could get through that scene or those mm-hmm. sequences. And you have small little glimpses of more well-roundedness from a couple of characters a couple of times. But James Halliday felt like you said, the man. Like, he mm-hmm. felt like a character. He felt he didn't even have to say anything. The nonverbals, the posture, the hairstyle, the everything about how they pulled off that character was, I thought, massively impressive compared to the rest, because you really don't see him very much. The characters talk about him a lot, mm-hmm. but you don't get to really know him except by the way that he's played.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I knew him the most out of anybody, and not in like a, oh, I kind of get him because sometimes I'm socially awkward or whatever, but like, I just felt like it was,
we weren't going to say anything, Chad, but you know,
truly the, by leaps and bounds, the best performance in the film.
100%. I agree with you 100% on that. And like I said, it was one of those instances where if you were to get anybody right, like if you were a filmmaker, and you had to translate this novel into a 2.5-hour film, who were you going to put the most amount of effort into really fine-tuning and honing a particular character? And I'm glad that they chose. I don't know if it was a choice, obviously, with the lack of time and obviously future film promised sequels to this film. There was no real promise that this film was going to, you know, really... You know, so what I'm saying is that if you're going to focus on one particular character in a film with the amount of time you have, I'm glad it was this particular one, is what I'm saying.
Well, I think that there's a lot, like, the bulk of the story is about him without you actually seeing him, because he made the world, right? And they're all playing his game. They're trying to win his fortune and take over his, you know, environment that he made for everybody. So, it's a bit of a cheat to say that you don't see him very much, because you don't see him very much, but you learn a lot about the character. Mm. However, what you learn about the character it just really finds a home in the performance. Mm-hmm. Everything that you learn about the character matches in this kind of beautifully awkward, somewhat tragic way with the way that Rylance plays James Halliday.
And it would be, it would be a cheap shot to say, well, the book goes into depth. There's a whole chapter, blah, blah, blah. Yes, there are chapters in the book that are dedicated to really honing in on creating the persona for this particular character. It really does go through the backstory. It really does the flashback sequences where, you know, when they were doing, you know, creating gregarious games and they were developing the Oasis, blah, blah, blah. But going back to what Spencer had said, you know, unfortunately, this is not a verbatim, you know, from the book. This is not verbatim. You're not going to get all the exact storylines. But going back to what I said earlier, I'm glad that they put the time and effort into creating and, you know, really fleshing out this particular character. Even if it's not with the script, Mark Rylance does a phenomenal job in this character. And I think to anybody who actually cares about the original story and loves the book, you're going to recognize that right away. But that goes to the overall direction of the director himself. I mean, when you have somebody in the driver's seat of any adaptation, obviously you have to focus on, okay, what is most important? What is the most vital part of this story that should be translated so that we can create a cohesive and solid storyline through this film? And, I mean, really, was there anybody better than Steven Spielberg? I mean, if
not from the sound of it. I mean, isn't his stuff like half of the references in the book?
He is pretty much 85% of most of the references, from everything from E.T. to his work with the Indiana Jones series to Jurassic Park to everything else that's mentioned in the actual, Anorak's Almanac?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a compendium of information that is released. It's kind of like the library that everybody has access to in the...
Uh-huh.
It's similar, but it's in a book form, digital.
That everybody can access.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's slight deviation, but I like the changeover and whatnot with the actual building and whatnot. But going back to Steven Spielberg, the fact that he is mentioned so many times and then you actually have the opportunity to have him direct this film was like, you know, lightning strike.
Legendary.
Legend.
Wait for it.
Dairy. Dairy, Spencer. Dairy.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, though, I was reading the Entertainment Weekly article from the latest issue, which is focused on cover stories on Ready Player One. And I was reading how Spielberg, when he took this project on, he basically said, okay, it's flattering and all that I'm in the book so much. Like, my references to my projects are in the book and have shaped a lot of, you know, your experience of the 80s and the way the story flows. I don't want this movie to come off as self-serving, so we're not going to talk about any of my stuff. Like, anything I directed, most of what I produced, he allowed the DeLorean to be in it because of the, you know, prominence of, like, how cool it is to have that, because he produced Back to the Future. He didn't direct it.
Right.
They've got some nice nods to Zemeckis.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, they kept trying to sneak things in, even into the set decoration, in the far backdrop of a scene that you're not even ever going to see, like, through the camera lens. He would find it on set and strike it from the set.
Yeah. And that's... So, here's my thoughts on that. I mean, you have to recognize the impact that you have on the world around you. If you've been doing something for so long, if you've been a part of a particular industry that has been shaped by your hands because of the films that you create, or because of the projects that you do, or because of whatever the result of those hands and that handiwork that you've been doing, if all of those things have been shaped by the things that you do, then I think you have to just kind of give it its little due, if you will, and allow those kinds of things to just do what it's going to do. I mean, obviously, a lot of it was waving and nodding at all the things that Steven Spielberg has done, especially his impact in the 80s. No question there. But to say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's self-serving. It's just, well, it's not really self-serving, because what it is it's serving the overall story of this film, because the film itself is, or the book itself, completely dives into his entire filmography. Everything that this man has touched, he is practically one of the trinity that make up the god of the 80s for Ernest Cline. You know, and so it's like you got
wow,
like,
that's quite a claim.
You should put that on a business card, like I 80s should. God.
I mean, you got the trinity of like Steven Spielberg, and then you got Michael Jackson, and then you got, you know, someone else. I don't know. <It's> just, but either way, though, Steven Spielberg has shaped the way 80s films have pretty much come to be what they are. And so with that impact being recognized and praised over and over in the book, I don't think it would have been self-serving to be able to just continue with allowing certain pieces, certain elements that were not in the film to have been in the film so that you could actually continue and make really cool references.
Do you feel like having read the book and had mm-hmm. all those references in there versus now seeing the movie, do you feel like keeping some of those elements out handicaps the movie, the way the story works in any way in the movie?
I think the way that, okay, so the way the movie works.
Obviously, the basic mechanics are the same. You've got to get the key, do some challenge, get the keys, get to the egg and inherit the oasis, and you've got bad guys on your tail, right? Yes. So, like, the basic mechanics are the same, but any of the nuanced elements of the story, do you think that they suffered because he didn't want to include references to his own projects?
I don't know. So, no, it didn't, because of the fact of the reworking of the script and how they shaped this particular storyline. It really moves away from any heavy usage of films, because of the fact that the book itself, most of the knowledge is based on like scenes from films, or, you know, criteria that is pertinent from certain scenes of certain films. So it this film is fine without it, in my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think had it gone with a little bit more usage of certain pieces of information or certain parts of the film, certain parts of his films, I think it would have just added more to the experience. You know, it would have added more to the overall experience of a fan of the novel coming in and seeing it on the big screen, seeing something like, you know, Jurassic Park, T-Rex from Jurassic Park, and Indiana Jones, you know, swinging around, or you know, E.T. fighting alongside with everybody else, or stuff like that, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, somebody coming down on a ship from Close Encounters, you know, stuff like that. That would have added more just to the overall 80s nostalgic experience. But mind you, it doesn't take away from the current story that is being presented within this film. I don't know. What do you think, Spence?
No, I pretty much agree with that, because there's not really too much. Like, it's just a bunch of nods that you would have had in the background, which I thought would have been really cool. They still have, like, quite a few in the movie as it is. But, you know, like, Steven Spielberg's, like, filmography has just so much stuff in it that's just amazing that it has, like, a special place in, like, a lot of people's hearts. So it would have been cool to see, you know, a little something. Although I am super happy that they had Alan Silvestri as doing the soundtrack.
Because, composer, yeah. He was the composer for the film.
Yeah, and I just loved hearing, like, bits and pieces, like, throughout the movie of, like, the Back to the Future soundtrack. Just
quite,
like,
a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I love that so much. I thought it was super cool.
Well, it had several of them, actually. I mean, you had from Back to the Future, from the first one and from the second one, and just in the beginning alone. It had several of those nods. I think this film still, without Steven Spielberg's, you know, filmography and all the little Easter eggs that could have been in there, I think the film still does a great job of putting this story and creating the unique love letter that it is to the 80s within the film. I think there's still enough of a nod to say this film gives homage to the 80s. I think you can say it's a really big part of the overall story without saying that the 80s and everything in it is pertinent to, you know, breaking the code and finding the treasure to Halliday's Easter egg. I don't think that's mentioned in the film, but you recognize the nod. You recognize a lot of the information where it's all drawing from. You recognize, okay, so they're going back to 80s films. They're going back to this. They're doing that. So I think the film still does a great job of recognizing how much the 80s are impacting this book.
But well, in a way, I mean, it kind of created some space for the pop culture references to go beyond the 80s because,
true.
I mean, somebody like the Iron Giant as a playable character in this world, the Iron Giant was late 90s.
Yeah.
Right?
Very
so,
true.
And has quite a standout moment or two in the movie. And so it's nice to see him. But if it was all 80s the whole time, then, you know, they would have been, I don't know, riding a T-Rex instead or something, you know. Or, well, T-Rex, Jurassic Park was 90s too, so.
Yeah.
It's true.
I know what you could do.
What?
Have E.T. sneak up on somebody.
I knew it!
And his little light-up finger dissolves them instead of heals them.
And then he says, ouch.
Like in a creepy way? Yeah.
You're still stuck on Thor Ragnarok, aren't you, with Jeff Goldblum?
Yeah.
The melt stick.
Topaz.
And I know, obviously we said, you know, we're going to do minimal spoilers, and if you guys can do that, that'd be great. But what was one of your favorite Easter eggs in the film itself? Let's go ahead and start with Chad.
Oh, boy.
I'll give Chad a little bit more time. Let's go with Spencer.
I don't want to spoil this, so I'm just going to be very generic.
If you take mine, I will throw you out this window.
I don't know what yours is. But the second challenge, the entire part of the second challenge, I thought was just amazing. Mm.
Does that happen in the book?
No, it's
okay.
Very different.
Okay, good.
So I really loved
our theater that we were in for the premiere of this movie, mm-hmm. like had verbal, strong responses happening throughout that second challenge.
That's true.
It was so great.
Because of what was happening.
That was a great deviation. I liked that deviation 100%.
Well, it worked so well, too.
It did. What about you, Chad?
See, I'm still stuck. I
all right, we'll come
honestly,
back to you.
Honestly, I probably missed 70% of the Easter eggs because I'm not a gamer and I don't remember the 80s very well. So unless they were beating me over the head with the references, I might have missed them. I mean, a few. I thought that it was really, I guess I would say I patted myself on the back at one point in the climactic battle sequence. One of the characters arrives in a craft, and I recognized the craft, even though that character was putting on a certain kind of suit, let's say, and the vehicle that they arrived in had nothing to do with the suit that they name dropped. And I was like, oh, I know what that's from. And then I saw in the end credits that credit was given to it's a Joss Whedon science fiction Western property.
Wow,
so
that's a pretty deep credit.
The fact that I like saw like, oh, he came in on that vehicle and I recognized it was that mm-hmm. vehicle because it's not a long sequence.
No.
I patted myself on the back. Of course, is that an 80s reference? No. Is it a 90s reference? No. Is it early 2000s? No, I
it's
don't think so.
It's still a great reference though.
It's like mid 2000s. So anyway.
Oh man, my favorite Easter egg in this entire film was in that climactic battle.
Oh.
And everybody's battling, and H tells Parzival, here, take this little buddy, and here, or here's this little buddy or something, and he hands something to him, and what it ends up being is so great, and it is so wonderful, and I loved it. I loved the full, like, 3 seconds that happened after that.
I'm assuming that's also not in the book.
Oh, 100%
no.
No,
no.
100% no.
I
but
wish.
That was a fantastic surprise.
That was an incredible surprise. I was like, yes! I wanted to stand up and shout, but I wasn't going to be that kind of weird guy. But it was great seeing that, and I was like, this is awesome. I mean, it is still technically an 80s reference, because, yeah.
For sure.
So,
absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, obviously the film, like we said, it does deviate from the overall story. It does deviate from the book. It is not the book verbatim. Mm-hmm. But it is still a fun film to watch. Does it have issues? Yes. Obviously, there's some issues. As Chad mentioned, some of the characters are extremely two-dimensional, and unfortunately for the amount of characters in this film, you can't really put that much time and effort into creating and fleshing out those individuals.
Yeah, well, and there are just some things, like, for example, casual moviegoer Chad is looking at it saying, wait, how did they all end up in Columbus?
Yeah, like, that's
physically,
almost super
all
weird.
Of the physical, real-life people controlling these, like, avatars that are the best of the Oasis. It's like, I'm thinking, is Columbus is the only city that's still around? Is that why it's the fastest growing? Because all the other cities are, like, nuked or something?
Nuclear winter, that's what we're in.
Yeah, so yeah. I was confused because there wasn't any story set up for how they physically came to be in the same place.
And I think just for convenience, obviously.
Literally yeah. all of them. IOI,
yeah.
Why is that in Columbus? I don't know. Wade lives in Columbus. Artemis's real life person is in Columbus.
Yeah.
All the other ones are in Columbus. Yeah. So it's sort of like, well, hold on. Does the rest of the world not exist? And I really was thinking, here's what happens when you don't read the book before you see the movie and you're trying to follow the logic of the movie, but there are some things that are just basic logic that is questionable. It made me start thinking about, oh, maybe there is only Columbus. Because that would explain why there were so few cars in the racing sequence and why there are so few players competing in some of these areas. Because you think if the whole world in 2045, with 9-point-something billion people by that point, I'm sure, if the whole world comes in and out of the Oasis, those battlefields would have to be 100 times larger than they are. The maps would have to be huge. Mm-hmm. And you certainly wouldn't have the same few standouts every single contest, every single time, because the sheer layers of competition would be too intense. So I started to think, oh, well, they're all in Columbus because Columbus must be the only place. Like maybe there's, I don't know, Columbus and Louisville or something. They're the only two cities left. And Columbus happens to be growing faster, so it's the fastest growing city on Earth. You know, I started convincing myself that made sense of other things that I had kind of mentally noted throughout. Mm-hmm. Like, there are not really, I mean, when IOI employs 100 or so Sixers, which are the paid competitors mm-hmm. that just go in to try to win the challenges and get the keys for IOI to take over the Oasis, they employ about 100 of those or so, it looks like. And then you've got, I don't know, 20 other people on Earth that ever play these games with them. Everyone else kind of just wanders around the library and waits to be a paparazzi. So, I don't know. I was starting to wonder how many people there even are on Earth in this story by the time this story begins.
And that's, obviously, those are a lot of the little things that the film doesn't dig deep into, so it doesn't really establish well enough that aspect, which in the book the system is worldwide. There are still tons of cities around. There's still plenty of people, so it's interesting. And obviously the high five, which is the name of the five people that are at the top of the scoreboard, they're all from different parts of the world. So yeah, that was pretty convenient for the sake of the story. Spencer,
well, and again, it's already 2.5 hours long, so you can only devote time to so many things.
True. Spencer, was there any issues for you in the film?
It was like little things like that where, you know, it was weird that they were all in Ohio, especially like at one point, Daito... meets Artemis and then he bows to her and I'm like, but now you're from America, why are you doing that?
Right.
Like, it's like little, it's weird things like that they're just off slightly, so it was just a little off-putting, but usually they're just little nitpicks like that. I don't think I have any major issues I can think of right now.
So, going around the table, let's go ahead and kind of wrap this up here in terms of how many monocles. So, in terms of pass or fail, Spencer, does it pass or fail and how many monocles?
Definitely passes. I'll give it a 3.5 because I was actually very impressed with how they were able to adapt it into something that still made sense for the most part, besides everyone being from Ohio. But yeah, I think they did a great job.
Chad?
I would also give it a pass, and I would also give it a 3.5. I would give it 3.5 because, as stated before, Mark Rylance did a fantastic job.
So good.
T-Rex, absolutely. I wish there was more T-Rex in this movie because that was incredible. Yeah. And it got a couple of dings for me beyond the logic of everything. Yeah. I also was expecting IOI to be a lot more Skynet in terms of its reach and its power already. But like just basic things like the haptic suits come from IOI. So why not just not make them? You're introducing other competitors into a space that you're trying to dominate. Like, why would you do that? I know, like, yeah, people are paying for them, and so you're making income to further explore, but you're also giving competitors tools to compete against you to potentially beat you at the thing that you're trying to do for global domination. So they weren't very global domination minded, in my opinion, and it was a little weak sauce on their part.
Weak sauce.
Weak sauce. So some dings there.
For me, it passes. I'm going to have to give it a... Yeah, you know what? I'm going to have to give it a 3.5 as well. As much as I wanted this film to be a hit, a 10 out of 10, a 5 out of 5, a 5 out of 7, however, wherever you come from, in terms of your rating system. I wish that there was a lot more it could have elaborated on. I wish this could have been, you know, almost true to form, like most young adult books. You break them up into a couple pieces and let's let this story flesh itself out. I mean, you become successful off of the first film and you use that money into creating and investing in your second film, and you make a second film just as awesome. I mean, this film is so large in terms of everything it encapsulates that it could have easily been a three-parter or a two-parter, whatever. Could have been the next, you know, Back to the Future, who knows. But I think the film itself is a decent story. It's a fun film to watch. Mark Rylance is phenomenal. And yeah, I you know what? I had fun. But I think does it ultimately exemplify what I was hoping it was going to be? No, but I still enjoyed myself. So,
and honestly, for those of you who might be on the fence and somebody you know is wanting to have you like take them to the film, maybe you've got a young one in the house and they're wanting to go see it and you're the chaperone, or you know, somebody, a friend of yours really wants to introduce you to this world, it's not the kind of 2.5 hour movie that you really feel like it's 2.5 hours long. It does move. It's got a good pace to it. A lot of energy in most of the sequences. So you're not going to be sitting there twiddling your thumbs.
True. And this is one of those things where you could bring in just about anybody of any age. You know, you'll have people who recognize stuff from the 80s and 70s with Atari. And then you'll have people who are the more recent into the video game Overwatch with characters like Tracer and Widowmaker and stuff like that. So you'll ultimately have a good time either way. So let us know what you think. If you think this film's going to be awesome or you think it's going to really bomb, let us know in the comments on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we want to let you know of a couple of upcoming weekend releases such as Tyler Perry's Acrimony. Tyler Perry is not dressing up as a woman. And, of course, Ready Player One. So, and we kind of wanted to jump into a little bit of a dialogue, little conversation.
I don't know, did we? You have a question mark look on your face.
I do have a question mark because I wanted to ask you guys, and I wanted this to kind of be a quick kind of chat. Obviously, we're gearing up for Marvel's Infinity War next month, and in terms of where this film is going to go, I just wanted to get your ideas in terms of where the heck are we going to be left off on at the end of Infinity War? What is the overall drive here? I was talking with Chad about this earlier, and one of the things I wanted to say was, in terms of Infinity War, I'm hoping that, obviously, a lot of people die, so that we can kind of get a new grouping of superheroes, but I would like to see more of the focus of the space cosmic aspect. You know, you have a lot of characters like, you know, Star-Lord, and you have the Guardians coming into play, and I want to just see us move to space. So what
well,
do you
here's my thought. Space, even space is too small. Think bigger and smaller. Doctor Strange goes to the astral plane. Doctor Strange can go to numerous different dimensions. And one of the... He has, in the Eye of Agamotto, he has the Time Stone. But one of the other stones is the Reality Stone.
Yes.
Which can alter your perception of the reality that you're in, or it can put you in a different reality. So in terms of what Thanos could do once he has presumably every stone in the gauntlet, or maybe even not every one of them, but most of them, everything but the one that T'Challa and his people are still hiding, the Reality Stone is going to be in his possession. That's one of those that's accounted for, and we know that he's going to get. So I have him throw a bunch of them into one different dimension or multiple different dimensions, you know, like have them get banished and they don't know how to get back because, oh, Doctor Strange isn't one of them that gets banished there, you know? So you wouldn't even have to kill them. You could strand them somewhere.
So you're talking parallel Earths or even that whole multi-Earth.
A multiverse. Yeah, but it doesn't even have to be like an alternate version of reality. It can be like a reality that is populated by, I don't know, ghosts and insects. And they just fight each other all the time.
Ghosts and bugs.
I'm not recommending that. I think that would look
No, let's recommend that. That's make that a movie right there.
But I mean, so my point is...
Captain America, ghost and bugs.
My point is, you could stop and say, oh, well, kill half of the Avengers and destroy the Earth and leave Wakanda as its own asteroid floating as a new planet. Which everybody would be probably fairly happy with because Wakanda's awesome. But... You don't even have to do that and then like focus on space, right? Like have a bunch of them try to like flee to another place to gather more allies to fight him a different way. You could do that. However, the world of the MCU, if you will, is much bigger even than that. So while they've said, yeah, they want to do more in the cosmic space, they could do more in a lot of different spaces. And they could do it with the stones in the gauntlet. So it just depends. I mean, you could banish them to a different time. Banish some of them to the future. Banish some of them to the past. Have two of them, like, remarkably end up in the 90s. And it turns out, oh, they're going to be in Captain Marvel movie then. We didn't know that, you know?
Spencer, Chad adheres to the idea that the last stone is actually deep down within the heart of Wakanda, which is why that last battle occurs and whatnot. Where do you think the last stone is? There's a theory out there that quotes or that states that Jane Van Dyke,
Janet Van Dyne, the Wasp,
the original Wasp,
soon to be played by Michelle Pfeiffer,
that she actually had it and then shrunk down to hide it. That there's a possibility she might have it in some micro
in the like quantum realm.
Yeah.
This subatomic.
I love the confused look on Spencer's face.
Well, this is the first time I'm hearing about that. I'm like,
what do you think the last stone is?
Now that you brought that up, I don't know. It could be anywhere. It
could be anywhere.
On Tony Stark, for all we know, just at a quantum level. That wouldn't make any sense.
They just crushed Tony Snark into a...
Tony Snark?
Tony Stark. Tony Stank.
Yeah, it fits.
Yeah, well, I thought that... definitely, before Black Panther came out, it was going to be in Wakanda. And now I have no clue where the heck this stone is supposed to be, because apparently they didn't feel like it was important enough to tell us.
Well, wherever it may be, let's hope that we find out soon as the film comes out sooner or later, and we get to see it before it actually debuts in theaters. So, this has been an awesome conversation. And like we said, if you haven't seen Ready Player One, or if you're planning to see it, make sure you get a chance to this weekend and let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page or our Twitter page. But yeah, I had fun. You guys had fun?
Mm-hmm.
Better have
totally fun.
Fun. Good.
Awesome. So much fun.
Well, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.